On this episode of the Think Wildlife podcast, I interview Sanjay Molur, who is the president and executive director of the Zoo Outreach Organization. Sanjay has had over three decades of conservation experience in India and South Asia. He has been a part of the team which has developed the IUCN Red List categories and criteria at both a global and regional level. We talk in depth about his work across the 30 years on this podcast. Tune in to listen more.
Welcome, Sanjay, to our podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Anish.
My first question is that you were part of the team that developed the IUCN Red List categories and criteria. So could you just elaborate a bit about what the IUCN Red List is and what are these categories and criteria?
Well, that's a loaded question. It'll take me about 3 days to answer that. But to just crunch things into this podcast, I would say that it's one of the most important conservation tools that are available today in the world in terms of what we need to do to, first of all, understand what the status of species is in the wild. You know, we have a lot of species that have been formally described. We have, for many species, information on their distribution, on their threats and everything else. But a lot of this information is not gathered or compiled to give us any good information on how to use that. Okay, and so what the IUCN Red List does is that it helps us to compile all this information together into a format by which we can then deduce what the status of the species is in the wild. Okay, so it helps us understand whether a species is threatened or not, and whether there's adequate information for it, or whether we need to do the assessment at all for a species. So, I mean, there are 9 categories and, you know, 5 criteria. And the 5 criteria basically help us to understand whether a species is threatened or not. Okay, and these 5 criteria are based on broadly, something known as population declines, and you have restricted distribution. Then you have very small numbers and declines, and then very small numbers, and then quantitative assessments. Okay, so there are 5 different criteria. And if a species, based on the information available for the species, if it falls into any one of these criteria, and you know these criteria, each one has its own threshold. Okay, and so they're all quantitative thresholds, which means that, say, for example, if a species is declining by more than 50% over the last 3 generations or 10 years, whichever is the longer, then that species could potentially be a species that is threatened and can get categorized as endangered. Okay, so the threshold values are very, very important. And if the information that we have for the species in the wild falls within the threshold values, and if they also meet some of the sub-criteria, which means, you know, the data quality, which means the information that we need to use to justify those threshold values, then the species could potentially become a threatened species. If the information falls within the threshold value, but then does not meet some of the sub-criteria, whereby the information is not justified, then the species, even though it falls within the threatened category threshold values, does not qualify for being threatened. So there are various different nuances within the application of the criteria and the categories. So that's how it goes. Yeah. And the thing is that it can be applied at the global level, which means the entire distribution of species of the species worldwide, or it can be used at a sub-global level, meaning the species regional distribution. You know, say if a species is found all over Asia, and if we are doing the assessment just for India, we can use these criteria with like additional regional categories and criteria to apply it for within just India, or within just part of India also. So it can be broken down to various different geographic entities.
How do you think that the IUCN Red List in its current form can be improved?
How can it be improved? I mean, everything is a work in progress. So, you know, as we speak, there will be some little improvement that happens. So there are some, you know, updates that happen every now and then, perhaps once a year or once in 2 years. But it's not as many as it used to happen earlier. So these criteria and categories came about in 2001. So it's been 22 years and they've been in use. So broadly, the categories and criteria work. But there have been some minor changes with respect to, you know, perhaps defining something better or including or excluding some things, or the way you interpret some of those points, you know, in terms of actually interpreting the categories and criteria is what is gets refined every now and then. So you don't see much of that right now.
So you also developed the population habitat viability assessments. So could you just elaborate a bit about what this is?
Well, actually, I didn't develop it, but I have used the tools quite extensively in various different contexts. And this particular tool is to build a conservation plan for species, single species. Okay. And so we've done this in the past for several different species like the lion-tail macaques, the Asiatic lions, the Indian rhino, hula gibbons, gharial, and many other species within the Indian context, and a couple of species abroad also. So what happens there is the information on the species is gathered by inviting people to a workshop. Usually it's a 4 or 5 day workshop. And where, you know, everybody who knows anything about a single species that we are, you know, focusing on will get into the workshop more and, you know, provide information for a mathematical model called Vortex. And so it's a stochastic model, which helps us understand how the species is doing, and you know, it helps us project the status of the species into the future, and that could be any time into the future, say 10, 20, 50 or 100 years from now, based on what is the information we have today in terms of just not just its distribution, in terms of its migrations, in terms of its various different biological processes that the species has evolved with, and what are the threats to the species currently. Okay, so based on all that, using the environmental variations and everything else that goes into modeling this particular system, we can get a prediction of what is likely to happen to the species in the next X number of years. So that's the kind of protocol that we follow in terms of determining how a species needs to be managed. Okay, so it helps us in not just understanding what the species is going to, what's going to happen to the species in the next X number of years, but if we were to change the management scenarios, how best we could ensure that the species status would remain stable for the longest of times, okay, into the future. So it helps us not only understand what is there in the current situation, but if we were to change the processes, which means that if you were to incorporate certain recommendations in terms of how you manage the species or how you manage the habitats or how you manage the threats and all that, then we can ensure that we have a better future for the species in the future. Okay, so that's how it is.
So a lot of your work has been with amphibians. So what got you interested into amphibians?
My entire career in conservation started off with amphibians in terms of how I got interested. So this is a completely different thing in terms of what how I began my journey, and this happened in while I was in college, in studying in Bangalore with the pre-university, and then did my bachelor's in botany, chemistry, and zoology. So all those 5 years was sort of, you know, working on zoology, the laboratory. So, you know, I was very interested to know how where we were getting frogs. And I also noticed that the frogs were of different species, different sizes, different morphs, you know, and the supplier who used to supply them could not ensure or assure a particular species to be given to the labs every week. So every week there used to be a change. And so that intrigued me. So I started, you know, asking about and, you know, trying to understand what exactly was happening, and realized that the supplier had to go about 40 kilometers outside of Bangalore to collect species of a certain kind or of a certain size, which obviously he could not do all the time. So that got me really interested to look at amphibians as a subject and see what was happening to them. And so the curiosity made me want to get into this field. And that's how I got into conservation.
So why are amphibians so important for the ecosystem?
You can ask the same question for any species, for any group. They're all equally important. They've evolved, you know, over millions of years with a certain role in the ecosystem. And they play an important role in the ecosystem because some of them are predators, some of them are prey to the predators. Some of them keep the ecosystem balance in various different ways. And, you know, they are all there to ensure that the ecology is maintained and the entire system is sustainable. So amphibians and everything else are equally important.
What are the most pressing threats for amphibians in India right now?
There are quite a few. One is habitat loss is the biggest threat. Habitat loss, it's not just the terrestrial habitat, but also freshwater habitats that are under heavy threats, mainly because of various different kinds of processes that development and everything else has unleashed on these ecosystems. And so, you know, those are really problematic for amphibians. Urbanization also clearly has a lot of negative effects on populations of amphibians within the, you know, urban setup. Just to give you a simple example, when I moved into Coimbatore 30 years back, you know, during the monsoons, we would get calls from various people complaining that they couldn't sleep in the nights, or, you know, the days would be always filled with a lot of cacophony of frogs calling, raucous calling. That was 30 years back. You know, even about 20 years back, we stopped hearing those complaints, and because we stopped hearing amphibian calls. So it's a lot of different you know, things that contribute to the threats to amphibians in various different parts of their distribution. So what I gave you is from the urban thing, where urbanization has reduced their places to be and to reproduce and, you know, all that. If you were to go into the wild, again, you know, loss of habitat and ecosystem changes, especially to the freshwaters, have changed them a lot. And more recently, we've also found the chytrid fungus, which resulted in the decimation of more than 300 species of amphibians around the world. In fact, about 12 species of you know, endemic amphibians of the Western Ghats. Fortunately, we've not found any negative impacts of the infestations yet on the populations of amphibians, but our work is still going on to understand whether there is any impact of the chytrid fungus on the amphibians in the Western Ghats.
So do you think enough is being done to conserve amphibians in India, and how can conservation of amphibians be improved?
I can just say that we need to do a lot more. For many species, we don't even have the information, basic information, basic biological information, basic distribution information. There are so many species yet to be described. So while that is at one end, at the other end, we have a lot of new descriptions that are coming up and some information on their bioacoustics, their calls, their breeding behaviors and everything else. But those are at the research level. Okay. What we lack is a systematic approach to understand the threats to their distribution, the threats to their status. Okay. While the IUCN Red List helps us in sort of, you know, assimilating the available information to raise a flag, to understand what the status is in the wild, we still lack adequate information to understand the gravity of most of these threats to the species. We also lack, for many species, the threats itself that impact them. Okay. Now, what we can see, we can perhaps, you know, interpret something. So we can see ground amphibians, we can look at them, we see their populations dwindling over the years. We can see something affecting them. We can see habitat loss and all that. So, you know, ground amphibians are slightly easier to tell. But if you were to say, stretch that to Sicilians or stretch that to, you know, creatures that live underground, then it becomes very, very difficult because what you don't see, you don't know. And while you understand the, perhaps, you know, understand the trends based on annual census or, you know, just even not annual census in terms of amphibians, but how many you get to see and what their trends are, it's very difficult to say what is actually impacting them. What are the kinds of threats that, you know, are keeping them down or reducing their populations? So we don't have enough information on that. And therefore, because of lack of information, our ability to take conservation actions and have proper actions on the ground is highly compromised or limited. So that's where we suffer from a lot of these things. Yeah.
So now moving on to two of your main projects. So you founded the Wildlife Information Liaison Development Society. So could you just elaborate about what this society does and what is the idea behind it?
It was started in 1999, and it was mainly to encourage youngsters through networks, through building capacity and all that, to come together to work on various different conservation aspects. The focus was more on conservation research and a bit of conservation action. So those were the two main criteria for that. We also started the Journal of Threatened Taxa under this particular society, which has now reached 25 years of its age. And so we've been sort of, you know, working on various different aspects to do specifically with conservation. Yeah.
What about the zoo outreach organization?
Well, zoo outreach organization also does a lot of conservation work. There, the ambit is a little more in terms of doing conservation action on the ground. We also do a bit of research, but it's more in terms of identifying people, doing outreach programs, education, awareness, building capacity at a very different level, not just at the, you know, hands-on trainings, but also in building capacity at, for career conservationists. We also have publication called Zoo Sprint, and Zoo basically supports everything that Wild does. So we have a single building, and it's a zoo building that Wild also sits in. So it's basically, you know, complementing each other's work, but Zoo does a lot of different kinds of work. And Zoo is also in its 38th year of existence. So we have built up a lot of invaluable resources through our functioning over those many years.
Could you just talk about some of the projects you're working on right now?
Right now, I'm very excited about what we are doing in building capacity for youngsters, the youth, in terms of getting career conservationists going. Because in India, one of the problems is that people want to get into conservation, but don't know how to apply what is taught in the universities or in colleges. The challenges in conservation are very, very difficult for most people. So the attrition rate is very high. So this particular course that we are running, which is a four-month intensive course called the Ram Hattikudur Advanced Training in Conservation, is to help youngsters aged 21 to 35 get some good grounding on how they can convert their emotions to take conservation decisions objectively and scientifically. So again, you know, if you look at many decisions in India, what are known as conservation decisions have been taken because of somebody's emotions and because of their interest. So while there is good intention, the way in which they go about it is not really scientific or systematic. And therefore, it becomes more dangerous to the species or to the ecosystem than it is if somebody doesn't do something. Okay. So the training here is to provide that kind of critical thinking, that kind of scientific outlook, a scientific temper, build enough rigor so that people do not just do things wishy-washy and not just emotionally, but apply their minds, bring in the research, understand what needs to be done scientifically and systematically. That's the thing that we are really into right now. But apart from that, we have our projects in terms of restoring wetlands, restoring forests in Himachal Pradesh. We have freshwater conservation and subterranean fish conservation action happening in the Western Ghats. We have some restoration programs happening within Coimbatore. We have some research on shorebirds happening in Rameshwaram and in other areas in the coastal places. We have One Ocean program wherein we've got work on marine bycatch and looking at threats to sharks and rays. We're working with communities, and what we do is to try and be as inclusive as possible and not take any actions and decisions based on our outputs or our inputs rather, but take the inputs from everybody, all the stakeholders, so that we can build a more scientific and systematic program to conserve. Yeah. So in addition to all of these things that we are working with species, we have community programs that we work with people in terms of dealing with human-wildlife coexistence issues, especially with elephants, human-elephant coexistence. Then we have human-primate coexistence. So several of those different programs that we run within the country and abroad.
So how can individuals contribute to your projects?
Various different ways. So individual like you, you're already doing something like this. You're contributing in your own way to conservation. And if you want to do more, you can actually learn more about it. Perhaps, you know, it would be good if you're interested in conservation and promoting everything that you want to do with conservation or with ecology and things like that, to take up the Ram Hattikudur Advanced Training in Conservation, because it's a four-month intensive course that will give you the bite-sized information that you need to be able to do this in a more informed way. Okay. Because what we learn in academics is not really good enough to apply in the field. So that's one thing. So youngsters like you, I would encourage you to get trained. And, that's one way of actually being able to contribute in the long run to conservation properly, scientifically, systematically, and in a much needed way. But if you are working in various different fields, you can still contribute to conservation in your own way in terms of what you can do by volunteering, by donating, by interning and all that. So, for example, we have a couple of people interning in Himachal Pradesh right now in Chamba on the restoration aspects. And so they come from various backgrounds, but they're working with us for 3 to 6 months and they're going to look at those things. So that's how they are contributing. So, or if you go out, you're working in an IT sector or something else, and you go out on your weekends to protected areas or to natural habitats, just noting down your observations, you can note down them and publish them. Because, and if you have interest in photography, make sure you take good photographs, ethical photography, and then, publish them in our magazine, the Zoosprint, or any other magazine that's available. Okay. So I think that's the way that youngsters and anybody and everybody should be contributing to conservation. Very simple, Anish, is that we are all dependent on the environment, okay? No matter what we do in our own fields of interest, if we do not take care of the environment that we are in, which includes everything, living and non-living, if we do not bring it back into a shape, I think we're all going to suffer, and everything that we are interested in will suffer along with us. So it's important for all of us, each one of us, to get into conservation.
What have been some of your biggest challenges throughout your conservation career?
Several, many. It'll take me many hours to list them. I would say the biggest, one of the biggest challenges is to get people interested in conservation. Like I said, it's very difficult to make people understand that they are dependent on the environment. They are dependent on wildlife. They are dependent on biodiversity. Just imagine, 2 years back, we were all reeling under the COVID attack. Everybody in their free time, said, oh, nature is everything and this and that. Hoo-ha. And once COVID went away, that entire thing disappeared from their minds. So the biggest challenge is to keep people interested, to keep people engaged in conservation activities. And that is not just the Aam Janta, but everybody from the policymakers to the politicians to the businessmen to anybody and everybody who's out there, that we need to, get them back into looking at our ecology, at our living systems and everything else.
And my last question for you is that what has been your biggest learning from your conservation career?
Biggest learning, what can I say? What has it been? To trust people. To have the hope that the people will get together and save our wildlife, our environment, before it is too late. I think there is a lot of hope there, and that's my biggest learning. While I do get negative at times, and who doesn't? We're all humans, and we do get negative at times. There are many positive takeaways from all the things that are happening around us. And my only concern is how fast they can happen. So we can't wait for, say, the next 50 years before things to change. We need to start changing now. So my biggest takeaway is to be as hopeful and to do my bit in getting this knowledge out to as many people as possible and to encourage as many people to get into this field and to stick their noses to the conservation grindstone and work on it.
That's a good way to end the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks, Anish. Thank you very much.